Hello, everyone, and welcome to Mysterious Topics Podcast. This is John, and today I am joined by Sarah Patterson, who also happens to be my wife. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, John. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, I wanted to talk to you today about one of your interests, that you found this neat website that has to do with sharks, which you like. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, the website is called osearch.org. It's OCEARCH.org. And it's a tracker. Primarily, it tracks great white sharks, but it also tracks other sharks. And what they do is it's a nonprofit, and they tag sharks so that they can learn more about their breeding, their whereabouts, what they're doing in terms of feeding, migrating. And it's worldwide, so it's live time. You can find information of where these particular sharks are. They track them by GPS, so when they arise closer to the surface of the ocean, then they can ping them and determine where they are. And so some of these guys are spending an awful lot of time going up and down the eastern seaboard, and I just find it fascinating that they're able to do this and keep the ocean going.
Yeah, so now they have to tag them first, and that must be quite a process to get a great white shark on a boat somehow and tag.
Yeah, well, they have a special platform that was built, and I guess they've got some deals with Caterpillar and some other sponsors. But they bring them up, they bait them in, and then they bring them up so that they do this whole thing, tagging them, taking blood samples, checking them over within 15 minutes because they are alive and they don't want to hurt them. And they, while they're doing this, they also funnel water through their mouth, through their gills to keep them oxygenated. And then once they tag them and get their information, then they submerge it again and let them go. And they've got quite a few that they've been able to do this with. And the hopes is that, you know, over time, they'll gain some more information about sharks as a whole, but well, as also as far as the whole planet is concerned, because they're an important part of the whole food chain, and without them, the ocean would probably get out of kilter.
Yes, and it's important, as you said, to keep them oxygenated, because they're one of the breeds of sharks that has to keep moving in order to get oxygen out of the water,
exactly.
The great white. And that's the other neat thing about it, is that they really didn't know anything about sharks as far as their habitat, their meanderings, their moving abouts, and here they're able to track what they do. And there's one, I think you said it was the first shark that they did. Her name is Lydia, a great white shark, and she wanders all over the Atlantic Ocean.
Yep, and if you go to their website, you can actually track them in real time, depending on their last ping when they came up to the surface. And for instance, Lydia has been all over the place. I believe it's been a few years now, and she goes out up into up towards Greenland, and she's way down towards Cuba and way far out into the middle Atlantic. And what's fascinating too is some of these guys within a week are going from Nova Scotia down to Florida and back. So, and some are quite close to the coastline, and then some are out towards the deep waters. And they're, originally I thought, well, maybe they're going up north when it gets hot in the south, but they don't. They're going up into Nova Scotia and those areas in March, January, so that those waters are still pretty cold. So anyways, it's an interesting sight and an interesting concept.
Yeah, and I just wanted to mention one other thing, as long as we're talking about sharks, we'll have a link to all of these places on our posting of the show at mysterioustopics.com. But just recently, they released a video of what's called a ghost shark. And it's kind of a strange looking thing. It's got a real strange face. And I'm just looking here to see. It's actually known as the pointy-nosed blue ratfish, but they call it the ghost shark because, I don't know, it's just got a strange face on it. I'll have an image of a ghost shark on the posting as well. And Okay, so is there anything else about the osearchwebsite.com that you wanted to mention?
No, but you did mention the ghost shark. There's a reference on a website that they say that it might be what you'd expect if Oogie Boogie from the Night Before Christmas went swimming. And it actually resembles something you might see in the extreme deep waters. It's almost translucent in nature and kind of ghostly.
Yeah, it's got big black eyes too and kind of odd markings around the face, so it doesn't necessarily look like a shark.
Yeah, and they've never seen one in the northern hemisphere, and they haven't been able to catch one to do DNA testing. So once they do that, then we'll probably find out a lot more about them and their history.
Yeah, cool. And then there's one other article that you sent me a link to. It's about the shark embryos.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, those guys are nasty because I guess apparently
I think it's the sand tiger sharks embryos, I guess. It's just one particular type of shark.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It could be other sharks, too. But apparently it's the whole strong survive type mentality that the bigger sharks will eat the smaller sharks in the womb. And so the biggest ones will be born, and even great whites can have several pups at one pop. But it's kind of a barbaric concept to think that they're being eaten before they're even born by their own species. But I guess that way that it's more likely that those that are born are going to survive in the harsh conditions. One other thing about the OSearch thing is, you know, people have asked if what they're doing with the tagging is inhumane and hurts. They know that it's probably the most uncomfortable thing that they do to them. But they did also point out that when they usually pull them aboard, sharks as a whole suffer a great deal of pain out in the wild. They can get scars and wounds from other animals, from other sharks, from motors, from rudders. So a lot of times they pull them aboard and they've got several scars or nicks out of their fins and things like that, so that when they get this, it's like kind of like a rivet through their dorsal fin. I don't know, maybe for people it would be getting like a filling done with very little or no Novocaine.
Or ear piercing.
Yeah, and so that whatever pain there is, it probably isn't lasting as far as they can tell. And maybe that will change over time, that they'll be able to make that device smaller and smaller as technology advances. So they try to do things as humanely as possible for them.
Well, one other point I wanted to make about the embryo article you sent me is that it says that the researchers apparently found out why, and they say it's part of a struggle for paternity in the utero where babies of different fathers compete to be born.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
They have actually been inseminated by a couple different guy sharks, and it's the opposing babies that are at war, apparently.
Yeah, but even still, it's always going to be the stronger, bigger ones that are going to survive.
Right, but I wonder if the mother shark can feel that going on in there and thinking,
I don't kind know. Of
like she major needs Pepto-Bismol or something.
Yeah, or, you know, like there's kicking with humans. I can't imagine what sharks are doing inside there, especially if they're eating each other.
Yeah.
Gosh.
So, okay. Now, the second part of our program, I wanted to discuss what apparently is a controversy about the poem, "Twas the Night Before Christmas." And there's an article, there's a couple different articles I found, but there's one from historicmysteries.com that talks about an apparent family feud over who wrote "Twas the Night Before Christmas." Now, this was first published in 1823. In the Troy Sentinel of New York, just 2 days before Christmas. And the editor of the Troy Sentinel was Orville Holly. And he said in the piece, he's got a couple of paragraphs explaining that basically they had no idea who wrote it, but they really like it. And so they ran it. And as I said, that was in 1823. It was run a few more times in succeeding years, but then it was just kind of off the radar until in 1844, Clement Clark Moore came out with a book of poems. And in that book, was a poem that was called An Account from a Visit of St. Nicholas. So he was saying then that he had written this. So from that point on, if you look out at all the credits for this now, it's credited to this Clement Clark Moore.
Well, then also there was some question whether or not his oldest daughter, the oldest daughter of his reverend, had overheard the poem when she was visiting the Moors, and then she copied it to her own album. So they're not even sure if Moore wrote it himself or if it was gleaned from somewhere else.
Well, yeah, they were theorizing that possibly this friend of one of her daughters that had heard it and somehow got a copy of it. I can't imagine that she could remember it and write it down, but maybe she got a copy from Clement Clark Moore, one of his kids, and then she's the one that anonymously sent it into the paper. But if they're claiming that she just remembered it and wrote it down, I would have an issue with that. I don't know how you could remember it that well. And that daughter was of the Reverend Dr. David Butler. Harriet was her name, who was said to have possibly been the one who sent it anonymously. But then, as I said, in 1844, Clement Clark Moore came out with his book, and one of the poems was this, and it was in there. And he never confirmed giving Harriet a personal copy. He never mentioned anything about her, really, and he didn't really want to talk about this much. They did try to interview him a couple times, and he just kind of said, well, first of all, let me give a little background, because it is kind of interesting to know about this Clement Clark Moore. He was born in 1779 to a well-known New York family. His father, Reverend Benjamin Moore, isn't there a paint that's called Benjamin Moore paint or something, I think? I don't know if it's named after him or not. But he was president at the time of what is now called Columbia University, and he was the Episcopal Bishop of New York. Moore's father was at George Washington's first inauguration and gave last rites to Alexander Hamilton after Hamilton was mortally wounded in an 1804 duel with Aaron Burr. Clement Clark Moore was an author, a noted Hebrew scholar, spoke five languages, and was an early real estate owner and developer in Manhattan. So despite all this, he's really only known for 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, which legend says he wrote on Christmas Eve in 1822 during a sleigh ride home from Greenwich Village after buying a turkey for his family. And some say the inspiration for Moore's pot-bellied St. Nicholas was the chubby Dutchman who drove Moore to Greenwich Village to buy his holiday turkey. And as we said, he never copyrighted the poem and only claimed the poem as his over a decade after it was first made public. So that's a little suspect there. You'd think if you write a poem and all of a sudden it's published, you'd think if you actually wrote that poem, you'd say something right away.
Yeah, especially if that's what you're making your livelihood with.
Right. So the next twist to the story is that now some scholars believe the poem was actually written by Major Henry Livingston Jr. Now, who the heck is Major Henry Livingston Jr.? Well, his family, the family of Major Henry Livingston Jr., claimed that the Night Before Christmas poem was a private family practice they shared. They also insist that the first time this family tradition occurred was on or around 1830. Henry Livingston had Dutch ancestry, and his mother hailed from the Netherlands. A good number of references used in the poem itself do point to European origins, in particular Holland. At least some of the reindeer have their names lifted from the Dutch language. Donner and Blitzen may reflect Dunder and Bliksem, the Dutch words for thunder and lightning. Four of Livingston's own children, as well as a next-door neighbor, insisted that the tale was often told to them as early as 1807. Each even went as far to claim that there was a written copy with amendments and notations on it. However, their home burnt in a fire, which took all of that proof away.
Well, yeah, but the other thing is that originally the Livingston said that this was occurred on or around 1830, but it was published out in the U.S. in 1823. Even though they're now saying that it was told to them as early as 1807. So that, for all we know, it could be one of those kind of tales or stories that people, it's a verbal thing, like telephone, and that maybe it was Scandinavian or from the Netherlands, and people told these things, and it was somehow, or maybe this guy Moore overheard someone talking about it and sort of put a little spin on it to tell it, and then it wind up being published in New York.
Yeah, and so somehow Clement Clark Moore got a hold of a copy and started reciting it to his family, and that's why when it got published, without him knowing about it, he couldn't, or he didn't want to claim authorship at that point, because the real author he knew was somebody else, and he couldn't, so that's why I think he just kind of swept it under the rug, and who knows how that got out. Somebody overheard it from 1807 on somewhere along the line before 1822, and somehow maybe wrote it down, and it just kind of like the telephone game got passed along until it ended up in Clement Clark Moore's ownership. And the reason all this is more likely true that Livingston was the actual author is an academic study done on both men and their poetry came to the conclusion that it was almost certainly not possible that Clement Moore could have authored the work. Both the content and the structure were different to the prose used by Moore. It matched up better with Livingston's style. So, I don't know. It's still a mystery, and I'm pretty sure that this Clement Clark Moore still gets most of the credit for it, but it is interesting to know that one of the most famous Christmas poem, really probably of all time, is still a little bit of a controversy.
Yeah, and I know that when I was a child, my parents would read this to us right before Christmas, like the Christmas Eve. And as a child, I had no idea who authored it. I just remember looking at the pictures in the book and more or less thinking my parents had made up the story because they'd interject their own little sounds and noises. And sometimes they'd change some of the words, I know, because we wouldn't have known what they were depending on how old we were. But it was always a thing brought out at Christmas time, and I'm sure it's done like that around this country and several others, and maybe they're all a little bit different depending on the language.
Yeah, and I agree, and I'm sure a lot of people will recite this to their kids on Christmas Eve because it is kind of neat, and there are some words in it. Like you said, there's a word in the original poem, coursers, which apparently means horses, or it's a type of horse, I think, or something.
Yeah.
And Donner is spelled D-O-N-D-R. I don't know, there's a couple other like that. But so anyway, we thought to finish out our Christmas show today that we would recite that poem for you to close out the show. Okay, so here is 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. 'Twas the night before Christmas, when all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, in hopes that St. Nicholas would soon be there.
The children were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads, and Mama in her kerchief, and I in my cap, had just settled down for a long winter's nap.
When out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, I sprang from the bed to see what was the matter. Away to the window I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters, and threw up the sash.
The moon on the breast of the new-fallen snow gave the luster of midday to objects below, when what to my wondering eyes should appear but a miniature sleigh and 8 tiny reindeer. With a little old driver so lively and quick, I knew in a moment it must be St. Nick.
More rapid than eagles his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name. Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen, on Comet, on Cupid, on Donder, on Blitzen, to the top of the porch, to the top of the wall, now dash away, dash away, dash away all.
As dry leaves that before the wild hurricane fly, when they meet with an obstacle, mount to the sky, so up to the housetop the coursers they flew, with a sleigh full of toys and St. Nicholas too. And then, in a twinkling, I heard on the roof the prancing and pawing of each little hoof.
As I drew in my hand and was turning around, Down the chimney, St. Nicholas came with a bound. He was dressed all in fur from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A bundle of toys he had flung on his back, and he looked like a peddler just opening his pack.
His eyes, how they twinkled, his dimples, how merry, his cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry, his droll little mouth was drawn up like a bow, and the beard on his chin was as white as the snow. The stump of a pipe he held tight in his teeth, and the smoke it encircled his head like a wreath.
He had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed like a bowlful of jelly. He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf, and I laughed when I saw him, in spite of myself. A wink of his eye and a twist of his head soon gave me to know I had nothing to dread.
He spoke not a word, but went straight to his work, and filled all the stockings, then turned with a jerk, and laying his finger aside of his nose, and giving a nod, up the chimney he rose. He sprang to his sleigh, to his team gave a whistle, and away they all flew, like the down of a thistle. But I heard him exclaim, ere he drove out of sight,
"Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night." Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Ho, ho, ho.
Thank you.